Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, one of the few media locales on planet Earth following the United Nations talks on climate change in the lead up to the Make or Break meeting in Copenhagen at the end of the year. The Copenhagen deal will not just be thrashed out during 2 weeks in December. It's a deal that will be forged in the interim meetings that are taking place between now and the end of the year. An important landmark in that process was reached last week when negotiators from 182 countries completed their initial readings of draft texts for the deal during a 2 week meeting in Bonn. This week on the programme, we are very pleased to have an interview with Mina Rahman from Third World Network, giving her a perspective on where things stand at the end of that meeting. One scientific assessment of the current position was published in Nature Reports Climate Change last week. The conclusion of the piece by Malte Manshuizen, Bill Hare and others from the Potsdam Institute was summed up pithily in the title, Halfway to Copenhagen, No Way to 2 Degrees C. In the text they elaborate, according to this analysis, the current best Halfway to Copenhagen pathway has virtually no chance of limiting warming to 2 degrees C or 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial temperatures. Or, put another way, it is virtually certain to exceed 2 degrees C. Their analysis is based on the set of weak unilateral targets that rich countries have brought to the table. Although the science says that industrialised nations need to cut emissions between them by at least 40% by 2020, compared to 1990 levels to have any chance of staying below 2 degrees C, here's what rich countries are saying is politically acceptable for them to undertake currently. Canada, 2.7%. The United States, somewhere between 0 and 4%. Japan, 8%. The EU, 20% and possibly 30%. Norway, 30%. Russia and New Zealand won't even announce their offers until later in the year. And Australia's target is unclear, as it is expressed using a base year of 2000 rather than 1990. But the talks in Bonn in June actually had a mandate, primarily, to agree a group target for rich industrialised countries, which are referred to in conference speak as Annex I parties. This mandate was given in Poznan, Poland last December, and was left unconcluded after 2 weeks of talks in Bonn back in April. Now, at the end of a further 2 weeks, the matter is still unresolved, with rich developed country parties yet to collectively accept the scale of action that is now required of them. One UK delegate is reported to have said that 40% reductions are laughable. Yet the position of the EU, that rich countries cut by 30% collectively, is based on science that is not likely to keep us within 2 degrees temperature rise. So which of these two propositions is more laughable? And let's not forget that the rapid and dramatic restructuring that is now necessary in rich developed countries arises principally due to their failure to take adequate action to date. So it took a group of over 40 developing countries to formally propose that developed countries take on at least 40% cuts by 2020 compared to 1990 levels to keep these negotiations on track and on task. This proposal will now go forward to a short further set of talks in Bonn in August. Here's a conversation I had earlier in the week with Mina Rahman from Third World Network, who's been following the negotiations tirelessly from close quarters. Is it possible to just say a little bit about the Third World Network, who it is and its role in the negotiations?
Yeah, the Third World Network actually is headquartered in Malaysia, and it's a network of developing country organizations and individuals. It has offices in Geneva, Africa from Ghana, and Montevideo in Uruguay. And basically, the Third World Network focuses on climate change, WTO, biodiversity, sustainable agriculture, the environment as a whole, and trade issues and intellectual property rights. it supports developing countries as well in terms of their capacity building and other resources that they need in terms of content. And it also provides information on policy issues to developing country NGOs and networks. So it bridges both developing country governments as well as NGOs.
And during the negotiations, you do a kind of blow-by-blow summary?
Yes, we do what is called the Third World Network Updates. It's actually available on our website, and it provides a day-to-day account of the negotiations, both in the Kyoto Protocol process, as well as what is called the Bali Action Plan process. So participants give a view of what's going on, including folks who are not able to be there at these negotiations.
What would you say in overall summary, what the position is at the end of Bonn?
Actually, it was frustratingly bad in the sense that there was hardly any progress. And given the fact that Copenhagen is just 6 months away, the talks actually did not see any progress at all, particularly in relation to the scale of emission cuts that are needed by Annex I countries, who are developed countries, who committed themselves under the Kyoto Protocol to the second commitment period. See, the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol started in 2008 and will end in 2012. So the parties are required to conclude by Copenhagen the scale of emission cuts for Annex I countries jointly as well as by individual countries so that there can be an amendment to the protocol's schedule of commitments for Annex I countries. And as far as that discussion went, the Annex I countries did not agree to any scale of emission reductions, and they were painfully slow in committing themselves to anything. And in fact, Japan announced a midterm target of less than 8% reductions in greenhouse gas emissions based on 1990 levels for the year 2020. That means Japan actually is not doing very much, which is only 2% more than it committed to compared to its the Kyoto Protocol's first phase. So Japan was really painfully bad in such a figure, because the climate science shows that developed countries as a whole have to do much, much more. In fact, the Alliance of Small Island States were calling for an aggregate scale of emissions around the region of at least 45% by 2020 compared to 1990 levels. And a group of like-minded developing countries, around 38 of them, on the final day of the Bonn talks, called for at least 40% reduction by Annex I by 2020 based on 1990 levels. So if you see what Japan is doing, it's really, really minuscule. And the European Union is committed itself to 20% autonomously and 30% by 2020. And even that is not enough, because the EU itself is not just talking about doing all the reductions domestically, but it's talking about doing these reductions in developing countries and what we call offsets. So what we see on the table is very, very alarming and frustrating, and this is not a good sign as we go towards Copenhagen. On the Bali Action Plan process, developed countries were continuing to reduce their burden in terms of shifting the responsibility to developing countries by saying that advanced developing countries must do more to take on binding targets, or at least semi-binding targets, in terms of mitigation. And they were not responding positively to the developing countries' calls for a new financial architecture to ensure a massive transfer of financial resources from the north to the south, as well as technology transfer, so that developing countries can make the transition from fossil-based development to a non-fossil-based future. So again, we see that this was also very, very slow, and that the negotiating text actually saw positions which were poles apart. And in the meanwhile, we know that the United States, who is a party to the convention but not to the Kyoto Protocol, they have, through the domestic bill in the U.S., are only willing to do emission reductions to the amount of less than 4% by 2020 compared to 1990 levels. So you can see that this is really too little, too late for us to save the planet and to save the poor.
In terms of these kind of unilateral offers of emissions reductions from industrialized countries, I mean, that's the kind of wrong way to go about it, in a sense, isn't it? This kind of bottom-up process. Wasn't there a mandate for the Kyoto Protocol track to agree an aggregate, a combined target for all developed countries?
Absolutely.
So what happened to that? Was there any movement on that in the final session on Friday?
No, the developed countries continued to be quiet on that. They refused to have any aggregate scale for themselves. And this was why developing countries were forced to put some targets for them on the table, given the science and what's needed in terms of the urgency. So the way some of us who follow the negotiations closely are seeing this as a way of waiting for the United States to engage. Now, the United States will not ratify a Kyoto Protocol, and they've said that time and time again. So when the U.S. is not even ready to engage, the rest of the Annex I countries are also not willing to do more. So they are taking their time, and there seems to be no political will to move forward. In fact, quite the contrary is happening. We heard of some of the countries like Japan and others talking about the scrapping of the Kyoto Protocol and to replace the Kyoto Protocol for a new treaty. And the United States itself is talking about a new kind of agreement, an implementing agreement, which would make developing countries, with those they classify as countries with significant emission profiles, to do more than other countries. So this is what we call differentiation. And under the convention, this is not a category which is recognized. So what we are worried about is that there are attempts by the North to replace the Kyoto Protocol and to renegotiate the convention.
Can we look at financing? Because I know there's some proposals on the table from the G77 and China in terms of what they want to see in terms of financing and what they think is right and responsible. There's two aspects to it, aren't there? One is adaptation money, and the other is money so that developing countries can pursue a low-carbon development pathway. What are the G77 and China proposing?
Well, the G77 and China, which comprises about 136 countries, they came together to propose a financial architecture because for the last 15 years or so, despite the commitment by developed country parties to ensure financial resources, hardly any money is on the table, either in adaptation or for mitigation, for technology transfer, to do the transitioning for developing countries. So what the G77 China came up with is a proposal to suggest that there be a comprehensive funding mechanism which will ensure that an assigned amount of money would be committed. And they have suggested 0.5 to 1% of the GNP of the Annex 1 countries. Even that, if you look at what is really needed for adaptation mitigation, is really not enough, nowhere near the scale of what is needed. But even that proposal did not receive a positive response. In relation to technology transfer, the G77 China have called for a technology mechanism. And one of the most contentious issues were that relating to patents over climate technologies.
Patents, yeah?
Yeah, patents.
Okay.
Yeah. The G77 China is saying that patents should not be allowed for climate technologies because this is a global crisis, a global challenge. So developing countries must have access to technologies which are affordable and easily available. So patents are seen as conferring monopoly rights in the hands of the private sector, making the technology inaccessible or at the very least very expensive. So this call for exclusion of patents worldwide is really a very major call. And of course, the Annex 1 countries said quite the opposite. They said that patents and intellectual property rights are very important for innovation. Otherwise, the private sector cannot do innovation, and therefore they were insisting on patents over climate technologies.
Going back to the financing, I mean, I listened to the EU and US press briefings yesterday, and when they were, both of those delegations were asked about financing for adaptation money, they were either quiet or were saying that basically it was just going to come from private sources, so things like the CDM, the carbon markets. So they're not even talking at this point about putting actual public finances on the table.
Yeah, no, this is quite outrageous because if you look at adaptation, the private sector will never be engaged in adaptation because you don't make money out of adaptation projects. Because it's about responding to a climate impact. Like if there is a rise of sea level and therefore you need the coastlines to be strengthened, you're not going to get the private sector putting money there because that's not going to bring any financial returns for them. So expecting the private sector to be engaged in adaptation activities, it's really running away from the commitment that developed countries agreed to under the convention. And this is really the most painful part of the process because the vulnerable and poor countries who were not responsible for the carbon emissions and now being forced to adapt to climate change, having no resources to defend themselves in the adverse impacts of climate change that we all know about. So it's really very sad and outrageous. But what the countries, the US and EU and UK in particular, for instance, and Japan, what they're willing to do is to put money in the World Bank. And we know that they are willing to spend money in the climate investment funds of the bank, which are also for adaptation and also for mitigation. And what's shocking is that they do not want to put that money in the convention under the UNFCCC. And what the G77 and China are saying that the World Bank process is outside of the convention. There is no equal participation by developing countries. It's not country-driven, and it's driven by the donors. So they don't recognize the World Bank funds, but the developed countries prefer to put money in the bank and not money in the convention.
And the World Bank has a terrible history on financing high carbon infrastructure as well as being a kind of rich world tool, really, for getting kickbacks for its own corporations.
Absolutely. So, yeah. It's not an environment bank. It's not a climate-friendly bank. In fact, all the dirty, bad projects that we have seen, including the subsidizing of fossil fuel projects, has been under the bank. So how can you expect people to trust the bank to do a good job when actually what's needed is an equitable and transparent and inclusive process, which is not donee related, but much more as the meeting the obligations of Annex 1 for developing country financing of their mitigation and adaptation efforts.
So something under the control of the UN could be an improvement on that, and developed
exactly.
countries could have a lot more say in the process.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it was the G77 and China proposal was modelled after the Montreal Protocol Fund, where there is a fund under the Montreal Protocol, which manages about $5 billion, and small compared to what climate financing requires. But there is a good experience where parties work under the fund, and it has been able to deliver in making the transition from substituting CFCs to non-CFC gases. So in that sense, the Montreal Protocol Fund has worked, and similarly the UN Climate Convention Fund should also be given a chance to work.
Okay. There was a strong call at the beginning of the 2 weeks in Bonn from Friends of the Earth, issued a report saying that the CDM can't be reformed and it should be scrapped. Do the G77 and China generally support that call? And what kind of alternatives are on the table to carbon trading?
Well, basically, I think the G77 and China and many of the individual developing countries have actually said that when they propose the climate funds under the convention, they are saying that it should not be based on offsetting, meaning that it should not be a flexibility mechanism for the developed countries not to do their emissions reductions domestically, but to pass that on to the developing countries, which is what the CDM under the Kyoto Protocol was about. In fact, the history of the CDM is that when Kyoto Protocol was being negotiated, developing countries actually wanted a fund where money would be put when developed countries are not able to meet their commitment obligations in the reduction of their emissions. So it was like a compliance system where if they could not meet their emission reductions, that the money be put into the fund so that there would be a transition to a clean development path in the developing countries. But from a clean development fund, it has become a clean development mechanism. And for Friends of the Earth and many civil society organizations and indigenous peoples, we have seen evidence on the ground that the CDM is fraught with a lot of fraud, actually, in terms of accounting, in terms of the real benefits, and local communities and indigenous peoples in the name of the CDM have not seen any benefit, and the benefits have gone to those who are involved in the trading and those who are in the private sector. So in terms of real benefit and contributing to sustainable development, that really is not what the CDM delivered. So what we advocate for, and many developing countries also feel, that if there is sufficient resources under the financial mechanism, then there would not be a need for the CDM.
The texts have got very, very long over the course of the last couple of weeks. What do you think needs to happen between now and Copenhagen to get a deal that is consistent with the science and is also fair and recognises the responsibility, historical responsibility and capacity to act of the rich countries?
Well, it's quite clear that what has to happen is that as far as the Kyoto Protocol process is concerned, in August when parties meet, they must negotiate, Annex 1 must negotiate on the aggregate scale, and that by the time that they arrive at Copenhagen, that there is an agreement about the scale of emissions that is needed. That's on the Kyoto Protocol track. On the Bali Action Plan, it's really about implementing the mitigation and adaptation and getting the financial mechanism and the technology mechanism up and about, so that the decision in Copenhagen will be the beginning of a framework to allow for these financial mechanisms to fully bloom after Copenhagen. So this kind of decision is absolutely imperative. And of course, for the United States, they have to show much more leadership than what's being shown now and make a real comparable commitment to the Kyoto parties in terms of the emissions required. Now, this is a huge political challenge, and it's not going to happen if civil society and movements around the world don't mobilize and push for real political will to happen. So there's a lot to do.
I know RED is a kind of whole program in itself, really. It's not a whole series. Did you want to say just something quickly about where that is?
Yeah, well, actually, there is no developing country unity around the issue about what they call RED Plus.
Uh-huh.
Well, what this means is that apart from afforestation and reforestation efforts, which is covered by the Clean Development Mechanism in the Kyoto Protocol, developing countries have been calling for incentives to be given for forest conservation and sustainable forest management. This is under the Bali Action Plan. One group of countries, which is a large number of countries which is growing, are saying that any incentives for forests should ensure that there is a financial window under the financial mechanism which the G77 in China has proposed, so that that window for forests will ensure that it is not an offset mechanism. It will also ensure that the rights of indigenous peoples and local communities who depend on the forest are protected and safeguarded, and that there be transparency and participation in the way the resources are managed for forest protection, and also for halting the drivers of deforestation. And that's how they see a mechanism under the reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation being properly worked out. Another group of countries are also willing to see the role of the carbon markets in the forest, and they are willing to look at a global mechanism in where there would be a trading in forest credits. Now, that's very worrying for a large number of civil society and indigenous peoples groups, because then you take it away from the national focus and give it in the hands of the private sector. So that's incredibly worrying, and given the experience of the CDM, this is really, really frightening. So what we in the developing world are trying to do is to convince many more governments to move away from the market and focus on funding through the financial mechanism and ensuring that the private sector is out of forests.
That was Mina Rahman of Thoroughbred Network, kindly fitting me into her schedule earlier this week while she was working on the final TWN Bonn update. That pretty much wraps up this week's programme. For references, please visit the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org, where you can also hear this programme again, along with any others you may have missed. We're going to continue to provide information and analysis about the international climate negotiations over the coming weeks. And to end, here's Julie Ann Richards of Oxfam, reinforcing this week's key message. Thanks for listening.
Developing countries have continued the trend of being the most positive and proactive players at these negotiations. Over 40 developing countries, led by South Africa and China, have put forward a proposal today which outlines how much the total aggregate target for rich countries needs to be by 2020, and how much individual rich countries need to reduce their emissions in order to keep climate change below catastrophic levels. The world urgently needs wealthy polluting nations to react positively to the proposal that's been put on the table in order to set us on a pathway to a fair and adequate deal at Copenhagen.